Bienvenue au terrain des jeux. Nous sommes ici à jouer au basketball. Il va vous conduire à la victoire. Car un moment de grand effort et l'esprit du bel an qui vit en tous les mondes et l'esprit qui ne meurt jamais. Parce que basketball, oui, basketball a arrivé.
Jouer.
Welcome to BizCast Ball, the Biscuitball BizCast. My name is Corbin Smith. Our guest today, that's right, the one, the only, beloved Biscuitball institution, Bob Silverman. We're going through all the non-playoff teams during the playoffs. Why? Because life needs balance. Life needs contradiction. Life is about living. It's about being passionate. If you took all of these words and you put them in the voice of some traditionally cute woman, you would be utterly charmed by everything I'm saying right now. But anyway, Bob is our guest today. We talk about the Knicks. That sucked, right? Oh boy. And then we go through why it sucked, and then we talk about if they're going to suck in the future. Spoiler alert, maybe. And then we talk about some other things. So sit right back and enjoy. All right, I'm here with Bob Silverman. Bob is a frequent guest on this program. He's the king of Biscuitball. Or Biscastball.
Nice.
He's the king of Biscastball in his own way. He appeared on such memorable episodes as the one where we talked for almost 2 hours about performance art, and another one that I think was about JR getting traded.
Yes. My mom, by the way, loved the one about performance art.
Yeah, she thought that was a great episode.
My mom loved it. She said, "Oh, how do you talk so freely and come up with all those things?" And I said, "I like the sound of my own voice."
You
and
are fond of it.
Yeah, I really am. But mom really liked it. So it got a shout out from mom. But she doesn't have a Twitter and she doesn't like using her Facebook account, so she couldn't make that public.
Shout out to mom. Shout out to Mama Silverman.
Shout out to moms everywhere. Let's give a shout out
all
to mom.
Mothers. My mother. All
yes.
Just the institution of motherhood.
Yeah.
You know, it's beautiful.
Let's start out there. That's our high point. And now the Knicks.
Well, first, Bob, we're going to talk about the Knicks today. I'm going through all of the crappy teams and talking to people about them. I've spoken to Steve McPherson about the Wolves already.
Nice.
That was hard.
Hard. Why? The Wolves are – what's hard about the Wolves? They have a promising future.
They kind of have a promising future.
They have one player who I would trade the entire Knicks roster for.
Oh, Christ. All right.
At least one. Probably two.
But we are going to talk about the Knicks, which
Steve knows nothing of a bleak, grim, barren wasteland of a future.
I mean the second part of this is that, like, in addition to rooting for the Wolves, they also live in Minnesota.
I've heard it's a lovely place to live if you don't mind the cold, with a vibrant downtown area.
Who doesn't mind the cold?
That's true. I hate the cold. I could not live in Minnesota. It's true.
It's like nightmare cold. It's not like regular cold.
Not to delve in my usual gripes about real estate, but I bet you they can afford a place to live, though. So they're inside.
Man, you've been talking about real estate a lot lately, Bob.
Let me tell you, the last 3 to 4 months of my life, it's been a part-time job. I just, so the readers know, the king is looking for a new castle here, and it's been a lot of work. It might be over soon, but it's been a lot of work. In any case, I digress.
You did. Look. Oh no. Oh no. That's too loud. That's too loud. Let's take that down. There we go. Okay. There we go. That's perfect. Am I?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Okay.
I decided to do audio engineering on the fly, and it was a bad idea. All right, we're back.
All right.
I don't know, where are you looking, Bob? New Jersey or?
No, Brooklyn. There are some. I'm looking at some. There are some special programs for reduced income housing, for sale that I may qualify for.
All right.
So I may be able to not go to the poorhouse. So there's that.
It'd be pretty fucked up if they sent you to the poorhouse.
They should bring back the poorhouse. They should have debtor's prison back again.
They should not have debtor. Debtor's prison's bad.
Really? Then we wouldn't have all these poor people around. I'm sorry. I've been reading a lot of conservative tweets in light of what's happening in Baltimore, and I'm learning so much. If you want to see some really fascinating stuff, check out David Roth's timeline.
Oh, yeah.
It's just awful. It's really, really awful and hilarious. He even made the Daily Caller's list of the top 10 worst things liberal journalists have said about Baltimore, his tweet did.
Yeah. If you're not familiar with cerebral sports Twitter, I guess David Roth, the legendary David Roth,
weird sports Twitter. Can we qualify it as weird sports Twitter?
I don't know
Twitter?
If we're quite weird sports Twitter because it's right, like well, we're not it's like because little... we're not well we're not you know we're not like audio you know we're not like SQL programmers. You know, we're sure. We're all writers, pretty much. Most
yes,
of us
yes,
are.
Yes. Okay. So let's just say a subgenus of sports Twitter, which is sports journalist Twitter, but isn't mainstream sports. Anyway, whatever.
Classical Twitter. People who have written for the classical.
There it is. There it is. Right there. Nailed it. Classical Twitter.
David Roth, the king of classical Twitter in his own way. A tweet of his went viral. An excellent tweet, and he has been getting some replies off of this thing, man, that are horrifying.
They really are. It's really fun. He got into a back and forth with one of the Daily Caller writer, quote unquote, the one who came up with the Obama ate a dog meme that was so popular in 2012.
Was this what was this? Somebody said Obama ate a dog in 2012.
In part of Obama's book, I believe Dreams from My Fathers, it might have been a different one. I think he wrote more than one book. I haven't read either of them. In part of his book, he talks about
The Audacity of Hope. I just happened to remember.
Yes, yes.
It was like his president book.
I think in Dreams from My Father, he wrote about living in Indonesia, and this is going to horrify you, so please be ready. This is actually kind of awful, but he did eat dog meat.
Oh.
Yeah, it's awful. That's not good.
I might be on this Daily Caller writer's side.
There's nothing good about eating a dog or having a country where people are forced to eat dogs. There's nothing good about that. But he was living in Indonesia, and it was 20-odd years ago, 30, I think, now. And that thing happens. So the conservative media, which hadn't really fully read the book before, I guess, thought this was
It's been out there for ever.
It's been out there for a while. And anyway, this guy found it, this little nugget of truth, and thought it was hilarious and wrote a whole article about it. And then this went viral, and everyone sort of posted pictures of Obama eating dogs. It was sort of a weird response to the Romney tied his dog to the roof of his car.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
That was the way it got going because liberals were pointing to saying Romney is such a clueless, cruel-hearted, evil robot twit that he would put his dog, who was peeing and scared, literally practically shitless, on the roof of a car. The response was, "Oh yeah, well Obama ate a dog, so he's worse." Romney 2012. That was the discourse. This is the political discourse.
I don't know if either side of this is like. Look, I don't approve of either of these things.
No,
personally,
there's nothing good here. Eating dogs is not good. But you know, you're in Indonesia. You're living in a poor country. Someone offers you food, and you know, saying no, I can't take that from you, person who's sharing food with me, because I feel I'm going to take a moral stand. You can't really do that. You kind of have to go full Andrew Zimmern there and say, yeah, I'll try that. Tying dogs to the roof of a car because you're a dumb twit is not good either. But, you know, sometimes dads are dumb. But the whole thing is awful because none of this should in any way reflect on anyone's decision about who to vote for to be the president of the United States. So, yeah, it's all awful. In any case, that person who wrote this was one of the people. Got into, I think, like a 10 to 12 back and forth Twitter conversation with Roth, or David, as I like to call him.
Yeah, I know. I've met David personally. So
I know him.
I call him David in emails.
Yeah, we're close personal friends. Yeah. I even sometimes go, Dave.
That's how
deep we roll. So I'm just saying.
Whoa.
I'm kind of a big deal. In any case, kept saying back and forth, and it was just really weird and sad. And it ended with our friend D. Roth trying to say, thank you for your time. I'm sure you have much better things to do. And this person, who fancies himself a humorist of some sort, ended it with, that's what you think.
In fairness, these social networking people, like, do they have something else to do?
Maybe not. I don't know. It was just the saddest way, and it tended, I think, to be either funny, maybe self-deprecating, but I don't think so, or maybe a random tweet that went wrong. I don't know what it is, but it was just sad and weird, and online discourses are often sad and weird, except when you and I talk, then it's fun.
Yeah, then it's great. Yeah, we're perfecting the art form over on classical Twitter.
Over on classical Twitter, which is really quite the place to be. I like it very much, and I like that we have named it as such.
Shout out to all the classical Twitter homies.
Classical fam.
Classical
Ooh.
Fam. Bob Silverman.
Hashtag classical squad.
Damon Agnos.
Roll deep.
Redford.
Yeah. Yeah.
McGowan. All the classical brothers.
Mike Plitchy? I can't pronounce it.
The new editor, his name is Mike.
News editor whose name is Mikey P, we like to call him in the classical fam.
Oh, yeah, we always call him Mikey P in all of our email threads about the classical.
Yes.
Where we conspire against non-classical writers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really more of a, hopefully, a bloodless insurrection. But.
Oh, yeah, we're coming I for think, every last one of you. We're gonna,
I think
we're
we've
dumped the corpses into the ocean.
Off track. I think we've gotten off track again.
Oh my god. Wait, I'm sorry. Did a podcast we do go off track? I can't even imagine.
Tell surprise.
All right, so the Knicks were terrible, right? I can't quite remember.
Yeah, I think they finished with the record of 1-81, if memory serves.
Wow, that's very bad. That's very bad. The only game they won was that game against the Cavs.
0-82. But the Knicks' only win, I think, of the year was against the Spurs. No, they won that other time against Atlanta when they weren't supposed to.
They didn't win that Minnesota game, right?
No, they lost the Mega Tank Bowl.
That was, you know what, that was, I wrote about that game.
Yes.
That was a beautiful game.
It was really, really a beautiful example of two teams trying very hard to win, but not really being able to at all.
Alexi Shred is probably not like an NBA player, but if you put the ball in his hands and say, go, do, like something happens, you know?
Yes, he does. He does things. I wrote extensively about Alexi Shved for Vice and compared him to Russian car crash videos.
Yeah.
Which are not a good thing because people are still getting in lots and lots of car accidents in Russia, and there are lots of grifters who jump in front of traffic.
Yes.
Ugh. You didn't even read the article, man, did you? There were links and stuff. Links to YouTube videos that I had to translate from Russian with the help of Google Translate.
Oh, you don't speak Russian?
No.
What languages do you speak, Bob?
I speak French, although I've forgotten so much. I speak a tiny bit of Italian. And I like to pretend that I can speak German, but I can't speak any German at all.
All right. English, do you speak English?
Yes.
Yeah, because you're an American,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I'm an American.
Yeah.
Yeah.
American sports writer commentator.
Alexi Shved. Here's the deal. Alexi Shved was playing well. Someone else described him as making out like a looter in a riot. Ironically, for current events, that's probably not the best comparison to make. But Alexi Shved did well, period. Alexei Shved had however many games he played. I think it was like 11. 11 really good games for the Knicks. Small sample size, sure. But he was good. I want Alexei Shved back. Now, granted, that means trading a lot of their I can sort of score but can't play any defense guards away. But I definitely want Alexei Shved back in New York.
Okay, so the Knicks were bad.
The Knicks were bad.
They were unbelievable. It was a nightmare. Now
It was the worst season in franchise history, period.
Which is, there have been some seasons.
There was the last 15 years during which they were good maybe 1.5 times. There was the period before Patrick Ewing showed up and right after Bernard King, in which they were very, very bad. There was the period after the one brief time in the 70s when they were good, in which they were also very bad. And then there was their entire history before, like, 1952.
When they were an actual joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were really bad.
Yeah. Really terribly, terribly bad. But this was the worst. This is the worst bad Knicks team of all time.
This is one of the NBA's longest standing franchises, and probably the longest standing franchise that is not like draped in glory.
Yes. And they like to pretend that they are. They like to pretend that they're this storied franchise. That's the mythos that they hang around themselves. When in reality, it's the Frazier years, some nice Patrick Ewing moments, if you like really violent, terribly unimaginative basketball, and that's it. They have no story. They have a story. They're sort of like the Chicago Cubs in that regard, is really the best parallel for them. They've been around forever and almost always bad. Or the Philadelphia Phillies is another decent comparison to the New York Knicks.
So I have some questions.
Sure.
So we'll get into the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Why did they suck?
This year? Or for always?
No, just this year.
Just this year.
We're examining the body. Not the broken.
I did not think they would be this bad. I thought they might be on the fringes of competing for the eighth spot in the East, because the East was also quite bad. So that was my thought. That was wrong.
Yes,
trading Tyson Chandler for the poo-poo platter of broken Jose Calderon, never was very good, and to begin with Sam D'Alembert, some second round draft picks, and Shane Larkin made the team considerably worse. Because Chandler was the only thing keeping their defense from being vaguely competent, you know, ranking in the like low 20s. Without him, they were next to last all year. They could not guard anyone. They could not. They were the warm melted butter, and the rest of the league was a hot knife. They had no rim protection. They were filled with mediocre to bad athletes, and they couldn't close out on threes. And then Derek Fisher kept having them pack the lane, which resulted in lots and lots of fouls and zero defensive three-point shooters. They got lit up by anyone who could shoot from deep. And considering the trend of where the NBA is going, that was a poor decision, one that I hope he'll be able to rectify. And then, you know, for all the talk of the triangle offense working or not working, it got better as the year went on, but they just honestly didn't have any players who were good at basketball. So they could run any shaped offense they wanted. It would have made much of a difference. A bad trade, Melo being either out or injured for most of the year, equals really bad team. I mean, there was a game I would play towards the end of the year because I was bored of watching them. And I still did watch and rooting for the other team to win, which was how many players in the Knicks rotation could make the roster of the team they're playing tonight. And sometimes the answer was one. If they're playing another bad team, it was two.
Who was the one?
It's Langston Galloway towards the end of the year.
Okay.
I think Langston Galloway could make a competent team's roster.
Who was the two?
The two, You know, so I'd waffle between Tim Hardaway being, well, he was a former first round pick. He can shoot. Someone would keep him around for that. And saying either Larkin or Early for the same reasons as well. There's some potential there. And that was it.
So they were bad.
Very bad. And unlike, say,
on every level, was there anything they were kind of good at?
They passed the ball a lot.
A lot, not well.
Sometimes well. They had the one play that they had worked out like gold. It's a variation of something that's called in the triangle the blind pig, which is a great name for a play, regardless of whether it works or not.
This is a spectacular name.
This is a spectacular game. After the initial triangle is formed, the ball is reversed back to the weak side to a big in the high post. The second guard then makes a hard cut to one side of that big or the other towards the basket, a backdoor cut. And the big does a blind pass, staring, you know, like he's posting up in the high post facing the other basket. And he just bounce passes the ball behind him without looking to the guy who's cutting. And the guy grabs the basket and rolls in for a layup. That was a terrible play breakdown. But you can find, if you look blind big, you can probably see a good example of this. It made terrible passing bigs, and the Knicks have a lot of them. Cole Aldrich could run that pass like he was Bill Walton. You know, Jason Smith threw that pass well. Sam D'Alembert, they all loved doing this pass so much. Clearly they loved it because it made them look great.
For half a second.
It made them all look like, for half a second, they were all Mark Gasol running the offense out of the high post. And it worked like a charm. It worked. It worked really well. It's not a play many people run. And if the guy cutting gets a half a step on his defender, any decent pass will land right in his hands. And it usually the defense doesn't have time to rotate and you get a layup. It's a beautiful, pretty little play. Not a lot of the other things worked, but that worked like a charm.
Which Knicks big man did you resent having to watch the most?
I think you know the answer to that.
Is it Jason?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's Jason Smith, who actually started playing better towards the end of the year. It took a whole year.
You got Stockholm, man. He didn't play better, and you know it.
He did. He played a little bit better. He did. I swear, I watched
it. What's going on with his yellow wallpaper? That's all I hear right now.
He put up a 20 points, 9 rebounds, and 4 blocks.
Are you turning down the lamps in this house?
No.
That's all I hear right now. You're getting gaslit by Jason Smith, man.
No, he had a couple of nice moments towards the end of the year, but I hated Jason Smith. I hate him, hate him, hate him.
Is there a player in the NBA who's more like basketball player resembling, but not like manifest of an actual human being more than Jason Smith?
I don't understand the question.
Does Jason Smith seem like a real person?
I compared him in an article to a walking jar of expired mayonnaise.
Yeah.
That's my answer.
He doesn't seem real. His name is Jason Smith.
His name is Jason Smith. It sounds like he's on the run from the law and figures playing for the Knicks is the best way to stay out off the grid.
If the Knicks would have been good this year, Jason Smith would have been fucked.
He would have been gone. Yeah. Jason Smith, I hated. Of course, it's no fun. It's never any fun. I mean, I even enjoyed slightly rooting for Andrea Bargnani, rooting for
You sound broken.
Most casual definition of the word. Yeah, it was fun because even playing at his absolute best, he was still the worst player on probably the worst team in the league. Records be damned. I still say the Knicks are worse than the Timberwolves. I don't care what the records say.
How many? The Timberwolves play in a harder conference. I'm with you.
The Timberwolves play tougher teams. Yeah. The Timberwolves also, you know, the Timberwolves have actual pieces moving forward. As we've discussed, the Knicks have two. Maybe. They have Carmelo Anthony and his ever-disintegrating knees and Langston Galloway. Maybe Tim Hardaway. And they'll have whatever player they pick this year. That's it moving forward right now. and whoever decides they decide to throw some money at in free agency, which I don't have a lot of faith in because everyone is saying that they're going to spend big on Greg Monroe. I have sources who said, this is actual, I'm not joking. I have a source here or two. I can't name them because this is what we do when we have sources. I'm learning this.
I'll bet you I can pause this and guess who it was, but I'm not going to.
Don't do that because it don't make me deny it or whatever. Okay. Send it to me later on Secret Classical Twitter. Okay. In any case.
Okay.
Sources have said that, yes, there is mutual interest.
Phil Jackson. It's Phil Jackson. We all know who it is. It's your good friend, Phil Jackson.
No, it's not my good friend, Phil Jackson. Sources say
Phil Jackson likes performance art. He saw you clown back in the days.
I'm doing a real journalism boy thing. Let me finish.
Oh, sorry.
Sources say that there is mutual interest. All the reports that you've heard in the newspaper are correct. They are right. There is mutual interest between the Knicks and Greg Monroe. Joseph Flynn wrote about it, why this is a bad idea, why this is, there's no reason to pay Greg Monroe anywhere near $15 million a year, especially not on a Knicks team that still has Carmelo Anthony. That would be very dumb.
Yeah, Greg Monroe is a nightmare.
I don't know if he's a nightmare. Well, not a nightmare. I just don't think he's a fit on this team.
Why?
I think that.
Go ahead.
I think there are teams for whom Greg Monroe could be a valuable piece. I just don't think this is one of them.
Can I? I'm going to engage you on this for a second. What team do you think Greg Monroe would be a good piece on?
As a starter?
Yeah.
Because, as a starter, I could see him. He could work nicely as the power forward slot in Houston. I think he could be good, decent there. I think you need a team with a strong defensive center and without a real low post option of any kind. So he can be the guy to go to in the low post when they're not running whatever it is they're running that's not throwing the ball in the low post as a general framework.
I think Houston would not want a low post player. I think they would rather have a shooter there.
Yes, they probably would, although, they've been using Josh Smith there, who is, so I don't care how many shots he hits in the playoffs, he's a 29% shooter. People are letting Josh Smith have those shots.
He's been 33% since he got into Houston.
Good. He's still below average.
Look, I'm just saying.
You're right. Houston might not be the best example, but you want a team with a strong defensive shooter. But that's the framework. I don't think Greg Monroe is unplayable by any stretch of the imagination. It even worked halfway well in Detroit. They played well with Drummond and Monroe on the floor together.
I think Monroe is maybe a living fossil.
He is a testament to a completely different NBA. That is true.
And I think that the Knicks' plans with the triangle are maybe not the best plans, and I think that doubling down on that by signing Monroe was not a great idea.
No, signing Monroe is a bad idea, especially before the draft, so you know whom you're taking. Deciding that you like Monroe or you're going to sign him before that is the definition of insanity. New Orleans, I think you could play him and Anthony Davis together, and it might work.
Maybe. Yeah,
I could be. My judgment in this area is. I am not Zach Lowe in terms of sussing out who's the best to be put next to whom.
I can't. So, I don't have a number in front of me, but I'm under the generalized impression that Davis is not as good at comprehensive rim protection
as one might think.
I think he's good at covering switches, blowing stuff up, weak side help kind of stuff.
Or
but
how about Oklahoma City and put him in the Enes Kanter slot?
I think that's a pretty interesting idea.
Yes.
Yeah, because he's kind of like Enes Kanter, but Enes is just so bad.
Yeah, and he's sort of a slightly better Enes Kanter. Yes. Ooh, although Enes Kanter does have a little more range on his jump shot than Monroe does. Monroe is not very good outside of 10 feet. Not at all.
Do you feel yourself submitting to Greg Monroe? It seems like you've gone through some.
I'm not happy about it, but I would be what I've heard is, unless something weird happens, it's a done deal. That it's as close to a done deal as you can have prior to anyone allowed to make any official contact.
All right.
So I am fully resigning myself to hating this and then trying to figure out a way to rationalize how it could work.
Yeah. I mean, like you seem like you're six steps ahead almost.
Well, we're very advanced to this in Nickland. Stupid free agent signings and terrible, terrible moves by the front office are kind of our deal.
There's a 12-year-old playing in West Virginia right now who you have already you're already at the cycle where you think, like, oh, the Knicks are going to sign that guy.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. We're ready for it. Look,
we're going to overpay for it.
I and all the people saying this are wrong. I really do. I don't think it's a good idea. I have some guys in free agency who I think would be good.
Who would you like to see?
I think they need guys who can play defense and spread the floor at the wing position.
Okay.
Carmelo Anthony is a power forward, period. That's just a given at this point.
That's the other thing with Monroe. Is that...
Yeah. Carmelo Anthony's a power forward. You need to get a center. Whether you get that center in the draft, and it'll take a while before, even if you get the, you know, Willie Cauley-Stein, who's the best defensive center prospect, it's going to take him a while to learn to be an NBA caliber defender. So you need a center no matter what. I would like to see if we could steal the fine Robin Lopez from your beloved Portland Trailblazers.
Son of a gun.
We're going to give him all the monies and comic
How
books.
How dare you?
Sorry, bro.
I am so angry right now. No.
I would, or if not him, I think Costa Kufos be a nice player.
That would be weird.
Why?
I don't know. Does Costa Kufos seem like a New York person?
He seems like a character from the movie Eddie, so then yes.
Okay. All right, I'm with that. I'm with that.
Yeah. They need... No, he doesn't. But yes, your point is well taken. They need a defensive center, even if they draft one. They need someone who can protect the rim, guard on a switch on a pick and roll, and they desperately need bigs who are capable of doing that. The wings that I would throw all the money. There's no chance they're going to get him, but I would throw all the money at Jimmy Butler to see if Chicago gets short-armed and can't find its wallet. Odds are they will re-sign him.
If they Risendorf it, if you will.
Yeah. There's a 1% chance he leaves Chicago, maybe less, but you got to do that anyway. They're not getting any of the Kawhi Leonard or Draymond Green types. They're not getting any free agents at that tier, let alone LaMarcus Aldridge or Pau Gasol. I like Damari Carroll a lot. It might be worth seeing if another lovely trailblazer, Wes Matthews, could be had on the cheap because he's all broken now.
I don't know if you want to pay a guy who comes off an Achilles. I think Portland might deal with that, but I don't know. We'll see.
I don't know. It's a weird thing. I have no idea. Before he got hurt, I figured there was no chance they could get him in any case. Now that he's hurt, they kind of can, and they probably don't want to. 3-and-D guys: Danny Green, Chris Middleton. Probably it's going to take a lot more money to get him than anyone thinks. It's going to take everyone a lot more money.
I think the main thing anybody who talks about basketball is said is like, oh, Chris Middleton's gonna make so much money, and no, everyone's gonna be so surprised.
Yeah. So a couple of those guys, of the Chris Middleton,
Wes Matthews, Damari Carroll,
Danny Green, 3-and-D wings. That's what they need more than anything. The Knicks have about $30 million to spend. Any two of those guys is probably going to cost them about 25 minimum. And then you want to see if you can go bargain shopping and find guys who are undervalued.
We've gotten ahead of ourselves slightly. Let me ask the second question.
Sure.
Will they suck next year?
That's my answer. Just that kind of sound. It's a sad sound. Probably.
Okay. You okay? You okay?
Yeah. Okay. Probably. I mean, there is a chance that they could make a leap. If free agency plays out well and the rookie they pick turns out great, then I think they could finish in the 35 to 40 win zone.
What would free agency playing out well mean besides a 3-and-D wing? Because like a 3-and-D wing is probably worth like 5 wins. And
I mean, considering who they've been putting out there, anyone competent is going to be worth a few wins. It's going to be worth 5. Let's say they get 2 guys worth 5 wins apiece. That's 10 more. Let's say Melo playing an entire season at full health.
Let's say.
Gets you another, let's say, gets you another 5, right?
Well, no, so but now, I mean, Melo's probably worth about 10 wins. I don't know, but yeah.
We're not using the good wins above replacement metric, but let's say a full health, full season Melo gets you 10. Now we're up to 35. Let's say they bring back the great Alexei Shved and he plays well, or Langston Galloway.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say that, but go ahead.
Or one of their guys that they've currently got on the roster continues to does a better job than they did last year. And that's worth another 2 to 3 wins. Now we're up to 37.
Boy, I feel like there's a lot of optimism in that.
That's what I said. Best case scenario is 35 to 40 wins.
But even but that's like, I mean, there's like some fairy tales floating around there.
Fairy tales? Which of the fairy tales?
Cinderella, I think.
It's one of the grim ones where children are eaten. Yes, that is the absolute best case scenario. That is the leap that the Milwaukee Bucks made going
from the original story of Cinderella doesn't end with her meeting the prince. Did you know this?
No, how does it end?
Well, what actually happens is that they slip the shoe back on her foot, and then a bear leaps through the window, snaps Cinderella's neck and devours her. And the lesson of the story is don't try to move above your caste.
I don't think that's true.
I'm pretty sure it's true, Bob.
I really don't think that's true. I think I would have heard about that before.
No, it's about like European ideas about, you know, rigid class structure, all
hey,
that.
Hey, look, I get that. I get that. Look, Shakespeare was a royalist and felt that anyone who thought that the monarchy was not actually descended from God and the right and just ruler of England meant that the world would slip into actual chaos. Believe me, I get it. But I don't think it involves a bear snapping her head. I just don't think so. I'll look it up on the Google.
Okay, everyone should look it up and find out that
everyone
I'm right.
Search originalist Cinderella class warfare. Hashtag class warfare.
Do you have any other opinions about Shakespeare we'd like to get to? Even if they relate to the Knicks.
I like Shakespeare.
Okay.
I like the Knicks.
Okay. What Shakespeare play was this Knicks season?
Probably like 2 Noble Kinsmen, which he didn't even write, and nobody reads, and assumes that it was half written by, I forget which fellow, Elizabethan Thread, wrote 2 Noble Kinsmen.
Ben Jonson,
but it was.
Perhaps?
It's 2 Noble Kinsmen because it's like Shakespeare. Yeah, Shakespeare doodling around in the corners and someone else finishing it, and then someone selling it as a Shakespeare play because, well, he's got a bigger name. But this was a very Knicks team in one sense, and not at all really a Knicks team because this is Phil Jackson doodling around in the corners while he waits for an actual team to materialize around him.
What season was Gentlemen of Verona? Oh, okay.
Let's not go here because we're going to be here for 8 hours. You know it.
Oh no. So they'll probably not be good next year, but there's like a very narrow window. What if they signed Aldridge? What if they somehow signed Aldridge?
What if they signed? Aldridge is weird because, again, there's a bit of a Greg Monroe problem there. What are you going to do if you're feeding Aldridge the ball in the high post all the time? I don't know if it's worth it to have Melo being a weak side spot up shooter
for the. I don't think that creates a lot of open.
That's true. Not the best. And he does not like playing center at all.
Right. No, you can't play him at center. And a mellow Aldridge defensive pairing at the 4 and 5 would be disastrous.
He's not that. It's not a disaster. It wouldn't be good.
Let's say the best, absolute best case scenario comes and Marc Gasol decides to leave Memphis.
Yeah, that would be. Okay. But yeah, yes, let's say that happens.
Marc Gasol, practically born to play the triangle and a defensive hellion, plays center. Let's say whoever they pick isn't also a center. Let's say they get D'Angelo Russell.
Who's D'Angelo Russell? Wing? I root for the Blazers. I'm
wait. His name isn't D'Angelo, and I'm going to get so shamed for this because this is something I should know about.
Is it D'Angelo, the famous R&B singer? The Knicks should not draft D'Angelo. He's not that tall. The only thing
D'Angelo Russell is the point guard out of Ohio State. What was I thinking? I shouldn't second guess myself. D'Angelo Russell is a very sort of Brandon Roy-ish scoring guard, combo guard out of Ohio State.
Okay.
A healthy Brandon Roy. And he's quite the passer and quite the shooter. Not the greatest offensive player yet, but he could be a very lovely wing player. So you get Marc Gasol, you get D'Angelo Russell. He's great. Right out of the jump, Langston Galloway matures into a great third guard. Alexi Shved takes over the entire world. Melo is healthy and rejuvenated. Derek Fisher stops with his terrible substitution patterns and wacky refusal to create a set lineup. And they roll. I think he'd get to 45 wins from there.
In fairness to Derek Fisher regarding the set lineup, you wanted to see the same thing every day? Like, if they're not going to win, something has to happen. It's kind of interesting.
It was very weird. Even with a collection of mostly the same bad players, he went, I think, the first 30 games of the season without playing the same lineup 2 days in a row.
That sounds fun.
Yeah. That didn't help matters.
Maybe starting lineups are too solid. Maybe they need to be more fluid. Maybe he's an innovator, and you just don't know it yet.
Yeah, okay, moving on. Derek Fisher, look, he tweaked the triangle. That's my favorite Derek Fisher revelation about last year, is that he started out working the triangle qua triangle, and it was bad. But as it went on, he managed to work in high pick-and-roll spread offense sets that flowed in and out of a triangle. Beginning to the game, he was showed that he was not a strict constructionalist, and that he was willing to adapt and tweak and work within it so they did run some other things.
The Knicks played really slow pace last year.
Oh yeah, oh, worse than the league, slowest team in the league.
Weird. So they were a bad team that was playing slow.
Yeah. Now. You know, which is an odd thing because Phil Jackson's teams were not slow. They were not. They did not play at a slow pace. They usually played it around. Sometimes they were fast and top 10, and sometimes they would drop down to about the league average. But this wasn't. Phil is not in it's not necessarily a grinded out, slowed down philosophy. They just didn't have any guys who were fast enough to generate fast breaks and never stopped people from scoring. So there were no fast break opportunities to be had. And they had very few guards who could competently run a fast break at all. So there wasn't a lot of running.
So as far as will they be good next year? No, but you have an elaborate construction of how they could be.
Yeah, I think there's a possibility they could. I have a feeling you're talking no. I think you're probably talking more like around 30 wins would be a realistic projection. Again, no idea what's going to happen this summer. Maybe they magically pull some trades out of their hat that remake the team a la Boston in 2007, but probably not.
Yeah, that sounds pretty
good. I think they should trade Carmelo Anthony. I thought they should have traded him last year, and I still think they should trade him this year.
What would be a fair deal?
I don't know. I don't see any. There was a market for Melo last summer. I don't know if I see one this summer. I don't know who would trade for him.
He just signed last summer, didn't he?
Yeah.
Maybe because he didn't want to have to buy a new apartment.
He's got a lot of apartments in Manhattan. He's got a 5-story office building in Dunvo. He's got a lot of real estate commitments. And believe me, as someone who's gone through this, I know how difficult that can be. Why Carmelo stayed is, I don't know. He's a weird dude. Again, I wrote extensively about this, about Carmelo Anthony, and that he really does care too much about how he's perceived. And I think part of the reason he stayed in New York is because he was worried that everyone was going to say he quit the Knicks at their, you know, when they were down. Which is strange because, yes, someone would say that, but people would say he's dumb for staying. Said he was dumb for staying when there was a better chance in Chicago or even Houston anyway. So people are going to say mean things about Carmelo's free agency choice anyway, but he seemed to sort of fixate on the one. I have no idea if this is true. I don't know Carmelo Anthony at all. But knowing what I've known from watching him play for the last 4 years and hearing his comments, he's a very strange dude and an interesting, fascinating dude that does probably the worst job of presenting himself of anyone in the league. I don't have a metric for it, but say Dwight Howard, when he talks, he sounds like an idiot. But that's an active reflection of who he is. Kobe sounds like a psychopath often, but that's a reflection of who he is. LeBron sounds like something that was created in an Apple lab. And that's a reflection of who he is, which that'll happen when you're in this since you're 16 years old. But Carmelo's interesting. And sometimes he sounds like this sort of horrible buzzword quoting tech industry guy. And sometimes he sounds like a fascinating human being. And you never get the sense that any of it is accurate. And it's not that he's lying. He's just that there's a disconnect always between his words and what you feel like he's actually feeling or thinking. And why that is, I'm not still entirely sure. Though I wrote extensively about it, I'm still not sure why. So why he stayed, aside from the fact that the Knicks were offering the most money, which is certainly as good a reason as any.
What are state taxes like in New York?
Oh, they're brutal.
Yeah, so, I think Carmelo would probably make more money if he played in Houston, considering state taxes.
I haven't crunched the numbers. I don't know if that's true. I mean, you're talking about Luke giving away $30 million right off the bat, that he got more in New York than he would have in Houston. Does not paying state income tax equal that, maybe?
He only gives up $30 million because of the fifth year, though, right?
Right. So there certainly is a chance that he could recoup that in year 5, maybe.
Probably. I mean, at the very least, he would get, let's say he remains at least okay. Let's say his knees don't just completely bone-to-bone grind out. He just starts bleeding out of his toes. Like, he would still probably be, sure, like, $10, $15 million a year.
Considering where the cap is going in 5 years? Yeah, probably. I have a feeling he might have not gotten more money. But what I feel like is he wanted it's weird. I don't know why I still don't know why he chose New York. I still don't. Aside from the fact, I mean, who knows? Maybe he and Phil went to Phil's yurt and they engaged in a metaphysical conversation and he was convinced. It could be as simple as that. I think he wants – I do think, though, there was this question of feeling like he hadn't finished a job and was worried that people would call him a quitter if he left. And he felt – and in some ways that's noble, wanting to stay with something and feeling like he made a commitment to the city when he got traded here and forced to trade here, and that he needed to – that he committed to it and he's going to stay to finish the job. That's kind of noble. It's definitely noble. Even if it's not in his best interest, depending on how you define his best interests. It's a complicated mix. I wrote something about this last summer for The Cauldron, that calling any free agency decision by any player selfish is really wrong. That all free agency is selfish or none of it is. Everyone who plays in the NBA is dealing in their self-interest and putting a monetary value on it and saying less money equals unselfish and more money equals selfish, I think is just an incredible disservice to labor. Because owners' decisions are never characterized in those kinds of moral terms.
Yeah. I think there's a reason why every European player nearly plays in Texas. It's because they don't want to pay Americans like taxes.
Or they love barbecue. Or there are well-run teams in the state of Texas.
Yeah, that too. I think those things feed into each other. I think the fact that Texas has financial advantages feeds into the fact that you can run a smart organization there. Probably.
Yeah, probably.
And I think it's a weird thing to say, because I'm saying Texas teams have an inherent advantage and that helps them run their teams more efficiently. Normally it goes the other way, but like
I think there are a lot of factors. That's certainly one. I don't know if I would pin that as the top one, but in any case.
Okay. Third question. Is there we've touched on it very briefly. Is there a scaffolding on the team in place right now? Is there a set of players who represent like a scaffolding around which a winning team could be built?
A foundation, if you will. Building block.
A foundation, yes.
Yeah. No.
Okay. I didn't think so.
No. Maybe after the draft and free agency, you will have that. But right now, no. Right now, there's a bunch of guys who don't speak German looking at a set of floor plans that are written in German, staring at it and going, does anyone here speak German?
Who do you think they should draft? If they could draft anyone.
If they get the first overall pick, I want Carl Anthony Towns, period. All right. End of story.
Okay.
Carl Anthony Towns. I'll tell you how I would like it to go. If they get the first pick, I want Carl Anthony Towns. If they get the second pick, they will take Okafor if they get the second pick. But I don't know how thrilled I'll be about it. Talk about a monument to NBA of yore.
Yeah.
Jahlil Okafor, who would be the consensus first overall pick without a doubt. Even 10 years ago.
I read 5 years ago, maybe even.
Maybe. I mean, there hasn't been a franchise big like this who came out in a – I mean, the last one was his – you know, the last time there were two bigs at the top of the draft, it was Oden who was available. And everyone said, yeah, you have to take Oden. Back to the basket, center, defender, end of story. Yeah, 5 years ago, even I would say sure. If this,
but I mean, Okafor isn't even a defender.
No, Okafor's not. He's a scorer. Period.
Like ideal, Greg Oden would have been a great player.
Yes. True.
Okafor. I mean, I guess any ideal form of any player would be a great player, but like the first thing I read about Okafor was like, Okafor is not great at defense, but it doesn't matter because this, and I was kind of like, no, in the NBA, it kind of matters.
He got better as the year went on.
That phrase in and of itself, he got better as the year went along, implies
why he's not the number one overall pick.
It implies a lack of talent.
So that's why I'm saying 10 years ago, when the idea of getting a dominant back to, you know, low post scorer was the thing you almost had to have in order the NBA to win in the NBA, unless you had Michael Jordan. You needed a dominant post player or else you did not have a chance of contending. That's not the case anymore. It's just not.
No.
In fact, there are real problems with having a dominant low post scorer. You have to build a team in a specific way around him, and you require other, in some ways, harder to find pieces around him. At center, you need a guy who can protect the rim, at power forward / center, you need a guy who can A, protect the rim, and B, spread the floor, which is a combination that exists in maybe two guys. Or even one of them is Josh McRoberts. I'm kidding, of course, but you know it's the Serge Ibaka prototype, and
Davis.
So now you've got
a level, Josh McRoberts, certainly.
Yes, McBob, Anthony Davis. The names just rattle off the tongue, but those are the guys.
NBA drifter.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the look in Josh McRoberts' eyes really quick?
It's so dead.
It's so dead.
It's like a doll's eyes. It's like a doll's eyes, man. It's like what's his name? Robert Shaw's description of the shark in Jaws.
I okay
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, yeah, and I think he saw Coach K do some shit, and he's just playing the string out so he can live in a cabin.
He saw some things he'd like to forget.
Yeah.
In any case, so the second pick, they'll take Okafor. I would go Justice Winslow there. They won't.
That was the kid in the final, right? He was in the final?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. If they fall to three, anywhere from three to four, I think the pick has to be Winslow. Three to five even would be my first choice, followed by Russell, then Muddier, and then Willie Cauley-Stein. That's my big board.
At what point would you like them to take Bob Silverman?
I think I'm available as an undrafted free agent. I've got 4 years of college. I'm a 4-year senior. So
you're like Kaminsky.
Yeah.
How would you feel if the Knicks took Frank Kaminsky? Just out of nowhere. Love it.
It'd be fun.
All right.
Why not? Let's invest in slightly better Brad Lowhouse. It'll be fun. Let's invest in doesn't look like he just got done with Burning Man Kelly Olynyk. Come on, why not?
Look, Kelly Olynyk, I just want to say that guy tore Kevin Love's arm out on purpose.
My opinion is no, he did not. He's just too Kelly Olynyk to know that you shouldn't do that move once the ball is frittering away towards the sideline.
You're aware of classical Twitter personality, Huge Mantis?
Yes. I don't think that's his real name, by the way.
I'm pretty sure it is.
Okay.
He is an MMA enthusiast.
Yes.
He did a breakdown on Twitter.com. Don't know if you heard of this website. Where he went through it and pointed out that Olynyk did the MMA move exactly like the MMA move is done.
Okay.
And I'm saying, I saw it and I was convinced.
So you're saying he's a Kelly Olynyk truther?
I'm a Kelly Olynyk truther. Kelly Olynyk pulled out Kevin Love's arm fucking on purpose.
Okay. I don't think so. I think he just look. That move is done by every NBA bruising big. That arm bar move.
Not like that specifically and that aggressively. And it was I'm convinced. Kelly Olynyk is a goon,
and he doesn't know how to do it at the right time and for how long. But knowing how to do the move properly doesn't mean intent to injure.
But Kelly Olynyk went to Gonzaga,
right?
You know what they teach you in Spokane?
I don't
know. You know who else went to Gonzaga?
Your tail to the Pacific Northwest.
You know who else went to Gonzaga? Robert?
What?
John Stockton.
Yes.
The dirtiest NBA player who ever lived.
So did Adam Morrison.
The second dirtiest NBA player who ever lived.
you mean playing in a style which is there's an intent to injure or harm. You don't mean actually that Adam Morrison just has a layer of grime on him that will never come off.
Oh, no, he does. I mean, he does.
Right? Okay. I think Kelly Olynyk just does not have the tools of the trade yet. And I don't think it was.
Is not like this young, overenthusiastic guy.
Fresh faced.
Yeah. I mean, he played in college for a long time. He's, he's not like, that dude knows what he's doing out there. He's not good enough to do it.
Right.
I'm just saying, Kelly Olynyk tore that motherfucker's arm out.
Yeah. And now the Cavs are screwed little bit.
If Chicago makes it to the finals, that is the fucking biggest pile of horse shit I ever heard in my entire life.
Yeah, I really hope they don't. Boy, do I not. Boy. I hope Atlanta gets its act together.
Yeah.
That's what I'm hoping.
I hope LeBron tears them limb from limb or Atlanta gets its act together. Because I just cannot, like, Chicago will have spent the entire year.
Here's my prediction. LeBron is going to go old school LeBron in this series. LeBron's going to say, okay, I've been kind of coasting for parts of the season, especially on defense. Right now, I need to turn on the afterburners. And he's going to win that series by himself.
I would really enjoy watching that.
I think he's going to have to. the incredibly valuable on you Cleveland Cavaliers for depending on J.R. Smith is out for the first two games.
Are you?
You know, it came on the exact same 2 years exactly to the day that he elbowed Jason Terry.
I didn't know that.
Exactly 2 years of the day since he elbowed Jason Terry. J.R. Smith is the living embodiment of the parable of the old woman and the serpent. It should be. What did you expect? He's J.R. Smith.
Isn't that the frog and the scorpion?
There's a lot of parables involving animals. I'm city folk. I don't know. They're both there.
Wait. How does your parable go?
It's the same parable.
The old woman
sees an injured serpent lying by the road in front of her house somewhere. She's an old woman. She's got nothing better to do than search the ground for serpents. And she finds one that's hurt. She takes it in, nurses it slowly back to health, treats it with love and care, and it slowly gets better. And just on the day she's ready to say, "Go free, serpent, I have healed thee," the serpent bites her on the ankle. And as she lays there dying, she says, "Why did you do that? I cared for you. I fed you. I gave you all the love I had to give. Why did you bite me?" And the serpent says, "What did you expect? I'm a serpent." It's the same thing as the frog giving the
scorpion. The version I've heard is the frog swims the scorpion across the thing. The scorpion stings the frog right before they get to the edge. The frog drowns, and the scorpion also drowns. And the frog says, "Hey, what the fuck, man?" And the scorpion says, "It's my nature, you know."
Yes, same story.
It's sort of like you're in a graduate program. You get through the graduate program. You can't get a job. You say, "What the fuck, graduate program?" Graduate program says, "It's my nature," et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that is exactly what that's the story. See, it's tale as old as time.
Song as old as rhyme. Beauty and the Beast. Yeah,
exactly.
Did you try out for any Disney musicals while you were a working actor?
No.
You weren't that kind of working actor.
I was working, but I wasn't that kind of working actor. I don't sing nearly well enough to be in a Disney musical.
That's true.
You got to be able to sing. That's not my bag.
Pardon me.
Baby, I'm more of the funny voice and strange physical characterization school.
Okay, all right. Just wanted to get clear on that.
You think the Biscuitball listeners would like to hear one of the funny voice from one of my storied characters from Days of Yore?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, we did a version of Alice in Wonderland. In the year of our Lord, it was in the 90s, late 90s, we did a version of Alice in Wonderland called Alice's Evidence, which is a Susan Sontag thing. It was a very, very, very twisted version of Alice in Wonderland, and I played the White Rabbit, which was fun for me because I was wearing sort of tatters and rags and a vest and suspenders at the same time. It was fun. And the rest of every visible part of my skin was covered up in white grease paint. So before the show, I literally had to be oiled up head to toe in white face. And I dyed my hair white. So I was white. I was rocking the whole young Julian Assange look when I had to walk down the street too. It was really, really weird. In any case, I played the White Rabbit. And so I thought, how would the White Rabbit speak? And I don't know where I came up with this, but this is the voice that I used. Do a little stretching here.
Bob's a little sick, everybody.
Yeah, and I'm also a little sick.
He's pushing it. For you, for the audience.
For the Biscast Ball people.
Look, Bob always brings it when he's on the Biscast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm a warrior, as they say in the sporting parlance.
Yeah.
Here we go. Ready?
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, won't she be savage if I've kept her waiting?
Wow. That was more intense than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long were you in this show?
This show we did a couple of runs. We did a run during a summer festival, and then we remounted it for 6 weeks, I think. So 6 weeks.
Look, you're a professional actor at the time. Did this like murder your voice, or were you just fine?
You warm up. You get used to it.
Okay. Little throat coat.
Yeah.
Did they have throat coat yet?
No, I have no idea what that is.
You don't know what throat coat is? And it's probably just for actors who abuse their voice like I did.
There you go.
Anyway.
I wish I had pictures of that, because it's a really, really scary vision of me in that show.
That's an intense voice, Bob.
It's pretty intense, yeah. And it was it was a physically draining show, too. Oh, God. It was an hour and a half. And I was working... Like, I was actually in two shows at this festival, and on a couple of occasions throughout the festival, I would have to do both plays back to back.
Ugh, oy vey. So,
yeah.
That's terrible.
Which would mean do one show, quickly change, run on stage and do the second show. And they were both very physically draining shows. And so, because we're using all these Japanese derived theater training exercises to make these, it's a whole mishigas. Anyway, at one point during the second show was the Alice is Evidence show, and I passed out on stage. I was so exhausted. I was doing this long speech with this gesture dance where I'm pleading with Alice, and it was this incredibly physically demanding, and I'm going up and down and doing all these things and speaking in this voice and reciting this text, which is going back and forth between the crazy voice and my regular voice. And at the end of it, I'm just supposed to sort of peter out like a toy winding down, which I believe how the director described it. Yeah.
I'm doing it.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yes, just like that. And then... But I was so exhausted. I was in this theater, had no air conditioning, and I could see as I'm doing this speech, like a camera with the sight going in, so it's sort of slowly getting black, and I'm getting this little tunnel vision, and I could see that happening, and feeling myself getting tired and tired. Literally, I got through the whole speech and out, and I went straight down, and banged my head on the stage, woke me back up. And I woke up, and for a second, I didn't know where I was, and I was very confused. And then I realized, the play.
Were you concussed?
No. Okay. I was passing out from exhaustion, and then it was just a zest to the head that woke me up.
Oh, okay.
And
if you did it every day, would you eventually develop CTE?
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
Definitely. Definitely. And at the end of the show, I went to the director and I apologized for passing out and said, I'm just exhausted, you know, second show back to back, et cetera, et cetera.
Public performance is so weird, or just art. Very collaborative weird. Art is so weird.
Very weird.
There's literally no other occupation or anything where you would feel compelled to apologize for passing out on.
Yes. Yeah. And in this situation, it was totally appropriate. But the thing is, the director said, what are you talking about?
Bobby and I pulled it off.
And I said at the end of the monologue when I passed out there, and the director said, "Oh no, I didn't notice at all. Went great. Don't worry about it. I didn't even notice."
Good job, man.
Thanks. Back to the Knicks.
I think
We're running long again, Kel Surprise.
Oh my God, I'm so surprised. I just have one more major question.
Sure.
If you could, and I think it's already been addressed slightly. If you could swap out one position and or role on the team with an average manifestation of that role, which is to say an average player, a 15 PER player who plays average defense, who would you swap out?
It's so hard to tell because, I mean, I think literally you're talking – there's so few – let me put it this way. The rest of – most of the team is going to be swapped out next year.
Yeah.
The guys we know are going to be around are Anthony, Carmelo Anthony, Galloway, Clay Anthony Early will be back. And I think they'll bring up Thanasis Antetokounmpo, which would be nice. And – they might bring back Lou Amundson and or Lance Thomas. They like them. And those guys could be fine as the 12th and 13th man on your bench.
Amundson was kind of a grinder, right?
Yes, yeah. Very much a grinder and a scrapper. And he was very effective as a Knicks big just because he wouldn't take Jason Smithy in mid-range jumpers. He yeah. only shot oh, near the
rim. Jason Smith, man. That guy. Anyway, go on.
Uh-huh. And so they're all going to hopefully be – the whole team needs to be swapped out for at least average guys. It's so hard to say, well, if we can just fix this one part. The whole thing needs to be built before you can even know who's average and who's swapped out. The Knicks aren't even ready for this question.
All right. Never mind then.
All right.
Is there anything else we need to talk – do you have anything to say about Bjork?
Yeah, her show sucked.
Okay.
She has a gallery show at MoMA. It was bad. I went and saw it.
You wrote about it at the dailybeast.com.
I did. I did some extensive writing about things that had nothing to do with sports yeah. ball. Which was fun for me. You can read it. It's about Bjork and Lena Dunham and the changing nature of great cultural institutions, and go read it at the Daily Beast.
Can I address something you wrote about in the piece?
Sure.
You mentioned Dunham's piece. In the New Yorker, uh-huh. and I'm a New Yorker subscriber.
Okay.
And I think that the problem with saying that Lena Dunham's piece was in particularly bad,
yes.
is that Shouts and Murmurs always sucks.
That's a hot take, right?
It always sucks. It sucks. Like, but yeah. Like I'm Look, a. I've been a comedy writer. I am kind of still one. Okay. And every time I read it, I think this is the most milquetoast motherfucking shit I've read in my entire life. Sometimes Simon Rich writes something in Shouts and Murmurs that is good. Everything else in Shouts and Murmurs blows. Fuck Shouts and Murmurs. And fuck hers in particular,
that's
I suppose. I don't
that's
know. But
certainly a fair position to take. And I would say that, yes, the only reason people make us think about it is because it seems like Lena Dunham has been gifted this slot to which hundreds of thousands of other comedy writers or thousands – I don't know how many comedy writers. Many, many other comedy writers.
There are probably 1,000 comedy writers.
To which 1,000 comedy writers would give pints of blood, pounds of flesh, various limbs, et cetera, to have. And she just gets it in the midst of getting all this stuff. So that made people angry. And also, Lena Dunham always makes people angry.
Yeah.
So, yeah, which is, I think, the point I tried to address without your Shouts and Murmurs sucks.
Well, it does. Addendum. It stinks. Fuck Shouts and Murmurs.
Comedy's hard, man, is what I'm saying.
Look, it is. But it's not so hard that you can't write a good fucking Shouts and Murmurs, which apparently nobody can do.
It sounds like someone has a very stern letter to the editor of the New Yorker that they're composing.
I actually put it together with letters from a magazine. I cut mm-hmm. little letters out. It's pretty intense.
It's more of a ransom note to the editor than a letter, really.
I hope
that
New Yorker editors never hear this, and I don't get to be in Shouts and Murmurs now.
I really don't think it's a problem.
What? I could be in Shouts and Murmurs.
No, that the New Yorker editors are going to be listening to the podcast. Oh, okay. I don't think they're Biscast Ball people.
Okay.
To their detriment.
Oh, yeah. They're fucking up real bad. But I'm taking in this hot content. It's not totally out of the realm of possibility that I can write a Shouts
and Murmurs. No, it's totally within the realm of possibility. I'm not saying that at all.
I have written literary jokey fiction for notable publications in my life.
I'm agreeing with you. This is the sound of two guys agreeing.
They can call my agent, Agent McAgentson, and they can say, we want Mountain Fight Guy for Shouts and Murmurs.
Sure.
Look, I'll drag that fucking institution out of the goddamn swamp that it has fallen into with my bare hands. I will save you, New Yorker. Bob will never write a mean piece about you ever again.
It wasn't mean at all.
It was so mean.
Are you kidding? I ended it with New Yorker remains an excellent magazine.
What did you say about MoMA at the end of the MoMA piece?
It was not nice to MoMA. Okay, I was a lot meaner to MoMA.
When I went to MoMA, it was very nice.
A lot meaner to MoMA.
They had the Matisse exhibit. That was really good.
Fuck Matisse.
Whoa.
Fuck Matisse with a chainsaw, man. Seriously.
Why don't you like Matisse, Bob?
Because it's badly rendered design. It's decoration, man. It's not art.
Man, I liked it. I get.
Well, do you see that? You gave me your shouts and rumors hot take, and I went up.
And you gave me your fucking Henri Matisse hot take.
Yeah, my Henri Matisse takedown is that he's not an actual artist. It's just decorative crap. There, boom, topped it. Over the top, Sylvester Stallone, 1985. And on that note, I think we should end.
Yeah, have a good one, Bob.
That's it. That's as good as we're going to get. You too, Corbin.
Thank you to Bob. You can read his myriad works at The Daily Beast, Vice, Sports. You can follow him on Knickerblogger. You can follow him on Twitter at Bob Cieda. Where he presumably promotes all of these things if he's managing his social networking presence the way I do. You can follow me on Twitter at Corbina Smith. That's CorbinaSmith. We'll be back soon with another episode. Until then, have a good day.